Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings one and all from your crustily genial host, John Derbyshire, here with VDare.com's survey of the week's news. I am sad to report that after long consultations with VDare.com's medical team, I have been diagnosed with Trump disappointment syndrome. I'm told there is a 12-step program I can book into that is quite effective, but unfortunately it is massively oversubscribed and they can't fit me in until next August. For relief in the meantime, I shall continue to vent my disappointment here on Radio Derb. Before I do so, though, here, in a spirit of postmodernist self-reference, here is a Radio Derb segment about Radio Derb. As noted in my October diary, I am diligently transcribing old Radio Derb sound files so that people who prefer to read text rather than listen to audio have access to the podcasts all the way back to 2004. It's slow work, but I've settled into a comfortable routine. Anytime I have half an hour to spare, I do some transcribing. The years 2004 and 2005 are already complete. I am currently in August 2006. 2007 looms ahead, a vast, untranscribed Sahara stretching to the horizon. After that, it gets much easier, as I have rough transcriptions for most episodes. The text just needs cleaning up and standardizing. It's kind of creepy, though, listening to your own voice from 12, 13, 14 years ago. I feel like crap. That's K-R-A-P-P, crap, the protagonist of Samuel Beckett's play Crap's Last Tape. Quote from myself in an appreciation of Beckett that I wrote some years ago, a longish quote. The crap of Crap's Last Tape is the only character in the one-act play. He is a shabby man of 69. It has apparently been his habit to make a tape recording every birthday. In the play, he listens to a tape he made 30 years before, when he was 39. The taped voice of Crap 39 mentions that he has been listening to a tape from 10 or 12 years earlier, say Crap 28. Crap 39 mocks Crap 28, and Crap 69, listening, joins in the mockery. Then Crap 69 mocks Crap 39. Yet he keeps rewinding to an encounter that Crap 39 describes, a moment of tender contact, not explicitly sexual, with a woman. End quote. Like Crap, I occasionally find myself wincing at some of the opinions I held back then, opinions I would not now defend. Those winces have been occasional, though. On balance, I've been pretty consistent, as I darn well should have been, the podcasts starting in my late 50s. The truly depressing thing is listening to myself passing comments on immigration and the national question. Comments that I could cut and paste into today's podcast without them being at all anachronistic. In that zone, practically nothing has changed since the mid-2000s. And where things have changed, they've changed for the worse. Here I was in May of 2006, for example, celebrating the town of Herndon, Virginia. Quote from myself back then, following some local elections in Herndon. Quote, last August, the town council of Herndon voted 5-2 to spend $170,000 of the town taxpayers' dollars to establish a hiring centre where illegal immigrants could hang out while waiting for local contractors to illegally hire them for a day's illegal work. Of the five councillors who voted in favour of the hiring centre, four had their lunch pails handed to them by the voters of Herndon this week. The one who didn't got the fewest number of votes of any winning candidate. The chap who got the most number of votes was one of the two who'd voted against the hiring centre back in August. End quote. Well, that's nice. I can't find census figures for Herndon in 2006, but in 2016 the Hispanic population was 36%, while in 2010 it was only 26%. On a linear extrapolation back to 2006, it would have been 19% when I podcasted. On a linear extrapolation forward from 2016, the Hispanic population is likely nudging 40% now. So, the Hispanic population of Herndon went from less than 20% when I was gloating about pro-illegal alien candidates being voted off the town council to nigh on 40% today. Vote any way you like, listeners. It will make no difference. Immigration-wise, nothing gets done and nothing changes. Except for the worse. That segues naturally into the Trump disappointment segment, which I may as well make a permanent feature of the podcast. The one thing a national conservative can expect from our president is disappointment. The biggest disappointment is, of course, on immigration. No proper border, no universal compulsory e-verify, no tax on remittances, no end to birthright citizenship or chain migration or the visa lottery or the investor visa scam or the OPT guest worker racket or the ruthless replacement of American workers by cheaper H1 and H2 visa holders from abroad. And that's just to speak of formal, legal immigration issues. Illegal immigration is worse than ever. Headline from Breitbart.com, November 26th. Headline, illegal immigration under Trump on track to hit highest level in a decade. How many illegal aliens do you think CBP apprehended last month? The month of October, at our southern border. How many do you think, listener? Several hundred? A couple of thousand? Could it possibly have been even 10,000 or more? Listener, it was 51,000. That's 7.5 caravans, using the unit of measure that I introduced 4 weeks ago. One caravan equals 7,000 souls. 7.5 caravans in 1 month. Where legal immigration is concerned, you may fairly say that the president can't legislate. Only Congress can legislate. and the Congress reptiles just won't, because they're all bought and sold by the cheap labour and open borders lobbies. To which I would reply, true enough, but much of the success or failure of a president is measured by how good he is at getting Congress to do stuff. On that metric, Trump is an utter failure. Where illegal immigration is concerned, the president does have real power. Law enforcement power by executive authority. Power as commander-in-chief to deploy troops. Trump hasn't done nothing in those areas, but he hasn't done much. And what he's done has been timid, half-hearted. When I voted for Trump 2 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to imagine myself saying the following thing. But here I am saying it. I wish Trump would be confrontational. I want to see him throw down some gauntlets to Congress, to the courts, on birthright citizenship, on interior enforcement. Sure, the lefty judges and the Congress weasels will fight him every step of the way, but battle will have been joined, and citizens will be talking about these issues, instead of talking about who paid for whose lunch in Moscow in 2016. You can gather from that last comment that I'm not a fan of Robert Mueller and his investigations. That's not partisan on my part. I deplore altogether the criminalisation of politics. Chatting with the boss, my cousin Peter, on the video feed earlier this week, Peter said he wanted the Senate Republicans and the President to get some legal action going against Hillary Clinton, who seems to have broken all sorts of laws when she was Secretary of State. I disagreed. I yield to no one in my loathing of Mrs. Clinton. And I would pull over and watch with gleeful satisfaction if I spotted her in an orange jumpsuit doing weed whacker duty on some highway verge upstate. The trouble is, opportunity cost. While newspaper op-eds and TV bloviators are filling the political atmosphere with these investigatory leaks, these prosecutions over picayune financial irregularities and telling lies to congressional committees, as if congressional committees don't get lied to every day of the week and three times on Fridays, while all this irrelevant flack is filling the air, important things are not getting discussed or acted on. Worse yet, under cover of all that flack, wicked and subversive things are getting done. An example from this week. Congress has decided to double the number of H-2B visas for seasonal guest workers, which is to say, for foreign workers to do jobs that American high school and college students used to do in their vacations. This is the result of a deal struck between some key senators, Republicans of course, and cheap labour lobbying groups. To name actual names, the senators are Tom Tillis of North Carolina, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, and Mike Rounds of South Dakota. The lobbying groups are the Seasonal Employment Alliance and the H-2B Workforce Coalition. Concerning those lobbies, just those two are the tip of a mighty iceberg. Washington, D.C. is crawling with these cheap labour lobbies. They are brazen, shameless, and out in the open, to the degree you have to think they are mocking us. Us, working Americans. The H2B Workforce Coalition, for example, describes itself on its website as, actual quote, a consortium of various industry associations throughout the United States that have joined together to protect American workers by ensuring American small and seasonal employers have access to legal short-term temporary workers during peak business periods. End quote. See, they are protecting American workers by bringing in cheaper foreign workers to undercut them. You can imagine the hoots, the guffaws and the high fives around the conference table when they approved that mission statement. To be absolutely fair to the senators, they have had the decency to pretty up the pig with some lipstick about employers, quote, verifying their new hires through E-Verify. They're given a year to do the verifying, though. These visas are supposed to be for seasonal jobs, remember, and an E-Verify check takes about 30 seconds. And they're given a further unspecified number of years to verify their existing workforces. In short, the quid pro quo that the senators worked out with the cheap labour lobbies is a whopping great quo of 66,000 extra visas for employers in return for a quid about as substantial as wet tissue paper. And there is no political space for us to discuss this flagrant betrayal of American workers because we're all too busy gasping and swooning over a bounced check that some third-level Trump campaign flunky signed 3 years ago. I haven't quite finished venting my Trump disappointment syndrome. Do you mind one more segment? There were three things that I hoped for from President Trump. Action on the national question, immigration, citizenship, visas, the borders. An end to missionary wars and pointless foreign entanglements like NATO. And a boost to federal infrastructure programs. I think I've dealt adequately with Trump's failure on the national question, at least until next week's vent. On the second thing, some analysts at Brown University have come up with a full estimate for the cost of all our post-9/11 wars. And the phrase full estimate there means an estimate that includes not only the formal congressional appropriations, but also secondary costs like veterans care, interest on borrowed money in the appropriations, and war-related expenditures by the Departments of State and Homeland Security. Bottom line, just a wee bit short of $6 trillion dollars through to the end of fiscal year 2019. $6 trillion and counting. There is no end in sight here. As the blogger Zero Hedge observed in his comment on this, quote, many of those wars have become more or less permanent operations, with no consideration of ending them under any circumstances, end quote. $6 trillion is $20,000 per citizen, close to $50,000 per federal taxpayer. Are you happy that your $50,000 has been well spent? In Afghanistan? In Yemen? In Pakistan, in Iraq, not to mention, of course, the tens of thousands of troops we have scattered around the world in places where we're not fighting. I mean, thank goodness for the 12,000 troops we have in Italy. If they weren't there, a new Mussolini would come up in no time and go invading Abyssinia, putting the USA in mortal peril. As for infrastructure, well, 2 years into Trump's presidency, I don't see much going on, nor even being talked about. Here's a thing we might talk about. I mean, you know, a thing the infrastructure president might talk about. My colleague Fred Reed over at the UNS Review has been visiting China and posting his impressions. He's been especially enthusiastic about China's high-speed trains. He notes, for example, that you used to be able to take a plane for the 200 miles from Chengdu to Chongqing. That's two cities in China's southwest. Now there are no more flights. There's a high-speed train that takes a little over an hour. High speed, according to Fred, means 180 miles per hour. The train is way more convenient and less bother than taking a plane. If you fly much around the USA, you'll be seething with envy here. I'm assuming everyone hates flying as much as I do. The extortionate cab fares out to the airport. The security theatre at the departure gates. Don't forget to take your belt off. The cramped seats and the unresponsive cabin crews. A high-speed train down the Northeast Corridor from Boston to Washington, D.C. would be a huge improvement to our business efficiency and our human happiness. So why don't we have one? Fred points to a lot of reasons. Some of them are more excusable here than they would be in a communist dictatorship. Property rights, for instance. Others, like the lobbying power of the airlines, speak to correctable defects in our political system. And then, of course, here we are with opportunity cost again. Then there's that $6 trillion we've peed away chasing jihadis around the houses in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm always a bit wary of comparisons between first world infrastructure and third world infrastructure. Visiting Taiwan 2 years ago, I was much impressed by the cleanliness and efficiency of the Taipei subway system. What a contrast with New York. You can spend an aggregate hour standing on Taipei subway station platforms without seeing a single rat. But then, I reflected, they built their system from nothing just a few years ago, with modern materials and techniques. New York is stuck with what it inherited from 1904. So the comparison isn't altogether fair. It's not altogether unfair, though. Taiwan is a small place with almost no diplomatic recognition. The USA is a mighty world power with multi-trillion dollar budgets. We can't build a high-speed rail? Really? And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Another one of Fred's observations is that China is heading towards being a cashless society. Quote from Fred, "People go out at night without cash, which may cease to exist in a few years. China seems to have leapfrogged the credit card." End quote. It's not just China. Sweden is going the same way. The value of bills and coins in circulation in Sweden peaked in 2007 and has been declining fast ever since. It's now at its lowest level since 1990. This seems to me a really bad idea. It's a threat to liberty when every tiniest commercial transaction that you engage in is recorded electronically on some government database. And it's a threat to a nation's financial stability. Think solar storm or EMP attack, or just a failure of the power grid. Let's stick with cash. Item. The trial of James Fields began this week in Charlottesville, Virginia. Fields, 21 years old, from Ohio, is the fellow who drove a car into a crowd of Antifa rioters in Charlottesville last year. One woman died and several were injured. It seems disgraceful to me that it's taken 15 months to bring Fields to trial. The Sixth Amendment guarantees us, quote, the right to a speedy and public trial, end quote. 15 months doesn't seem very speedy to me for an incident that occurred in plain daylight before numerous witnesses. Friends of mine who are familiar with the justice system, however, tell me that it's not abnormal. This trial is in a Virginia state court. When it's done, Fields will also be tried in federal court on hate crime charges. On the state murder charge, he ought to have a good case. Local politicians had stood down the police force so that Antifa could run wild to disrupt a lawful demonstration. And it was an armed Antifa mob that Fields encountered. If he can establish that he feared for his life and saw the car as his only weapon against the mob, he might get off. The federal hate crime charge is just a ruse to get around the double jeopardy clause in the Fifth Amendment. It basically charges Fields with having bad thoughts. Hate crime laws are a disgrace to Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence, an insult to our independence of mind. You can't go to jail for what you're thinking, went the 1956 pop song. Well, in 1956, indeed, you couldn't. But now you can. And James Fields very likely will. Item. If liberty is in bad shape here, with the criminalisation of wrong thoughts, things are far worse in Britain. Britain's asylum laws are just as ill thought out and just as easy to game as ours are. So much so that the phrase asylum seeker is just a synonym for illegal alien over there. The laws on underage asylum seekers are especially daft. So, two lads arrived in England from Iran, we are not told how, claiming to be 15 and 12 years old. They were handed off to a charity, which found housing for them and placed them in schools for full-time education. Classmates of the 15-year-old, whose name was Sayavash, couldn't help noticing that he was 6'1" tall, had stubble on his chin and a receding hairline. Rumours got through to the parents, who tried to raise the matter with the school authorities. They were, of course, scolded for racism and sent away. This all got into the newspapers. The government took notice, and now Sayavash, who is at least 25, possibly 30, has been removed from the school. His younger companion, advertised as 12 years old, is still in the high school. He may be no more than 20. Item. There is a new wrinkle in the stories about Chaikom repression against the Uyghurs of eastern Turkestan. To tighten the social control screws still further on the Uyghurs, the Chaikoms have started deploying Chinese government workers to live in the homes of Uyghurs who have relatives abroad, or who are suspected of bad thoughts, of being too religious, for example. The Uyghurs are traditionally Muslim. Even if you don't have one of these carders living in your home with you, one is liable to turn up at weddings and funerals, on the lookout for thought crime. It's all very creepy. I should be careful about reporting these stories about Chaikom social control, though. You never know who might be listening. I don't want to give any ideas to our own thought police. Next thing you know, Google and Twitter employees will be fanning out across the country, asking to crash on the couches of people they've identified as bad thinkers. Don't laugh, this could happen. Nothing would surprise me at this point. Just be careful who you open the door to. Item. I can't say I've ever engaged much with Neil deGrasse Tyson. I'm vaguely aware of him as a science populariser. Browsing his Wikipedia page, I see he attended Bronx High School of Science, one of New York City's very selective high schools, so he's obviously smart. He's also black, though. An enormous advantage to a smart guy's career, especially in science. I have it on good authority that American universities fight like cats over the small number of black math PhDs that come on the market every year. They are desperate to darken up their math faculties. No doubt it's the same with other STEM subjects. That's the society we live in, though. It's not Tyson's fault, and I don't blame him for taking advantage of his black privilege. So, it was with only very mild interest that I saw he's been caught up in this sexual harassment hysteria. One woman has claimed that Tyson slipped her a Mickey and raped her in 1984, when they were both graduate students. A second woman, a physics professor herself, has claimed that Tyson groped her at an academic party in 2009. And yet a third lady says that Tyson made inappropriate sexual comments to her when she was working as his assistant in 2016, causing her to quit. So, from having no particular feelings at all about Neil deGrasse Tyson, I've now moved to feeling sympathetic and supportive to him. Where sexual harassment is concerned, my default assumption is that it's all a lawyer's ramp, and that the women involved are having the prospect of big fat cash settlements dangled in front of them by shyster attorneys. I could certainly report that if I had tried the things Tyson is accused of on the young women that I recall from the 1960s and 1970s, I would have come away with a black eye. I find it hard to believe that women have somehow forgotten how to administer a good smack, or how to utter phrases like, "Keep your hands to yourself, pal." Good luck fending off the harpies from the Trial Lawyers Association, Neil. And I promise to watch your next TV special. Item. Finally, I note with sadness the passing of Stephen Hillenburg at the tragically young age of 57 from Lou Gehrig's disease. Hillenburg was the creator of SpongeBob SquarePants, whose adventures provided much pleasure and laughter to my children and myself around the turn of the century. I find I can still sing not only the theme song, but also the promotional song for Krusty Krab Pizza. Krusty Krab Pizza is the pizza for you and me. Although it's been several years since I last overheard the kids speaking of me in the third person as Squidward. It's no small thing to have provided dozens of hours of harmless pleasure to millions of people. Stephen Hillenburg's was a life well lived and cut short much too soon. Condolences to his loved ones. That's it, ladies and gents, this last day of November 2018. Thank you for listening, and please make a note in your desk calendar that Radio Derb will be off the air next week. I shall be taking a brief vacation to energise myself for the Christmas season. Radio Derb will resume on Friday, December 14th. That's a shame, not just because the world will be deprived of my erudition and wit for a week, but also because next Friday is December 7th, so I miss the opportunity to tell my favourite December 7th anecdote. People my generation all know it, but younger listeners may not. This is a true story. Back in 1966, when Lyndon Johnson was president, his younger daughter, Lucy Baines Johnson, just 19 years old, got married. The wedding date was set for August 6th that year. There was a minor fuss about that. August 6th is the date we dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima in 1945. There were some indignant comments in the Japanese press. The daughter of the American president getting married on such a grim anniversary? Was this some kind of deliberate insult? When Lucy was told about the criticisms, she responded in proper LBJ style. "Okay," she said, "we'll change the date to, how about December 7th? The wedding went ahead on August 6th as scheduled. We don't make presidential offspring like that anymore. We don't write pop songs as good as the one I mentioned in passing a few minutes ago either. Here's a snippet of it to play us out. There will be more from Radio Derb the week after next.
Saturday, and I'm so broke. Haven't got a girl, and that's no joke. Still I'm living like a millionaire. When I take me down to Main Street and I review the harem parading for me there. Standing on the corner watching all the girls go by. Standing on the corner underneath the springtime sky. For what you're thinking, or for the world, look in your eye. You're only standing on the corner, watching all the girls, watching all the girls, watching all the girls.